Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. This is Lisa Anderson. Always great to have you with us here as we round out the end of June. Later on for our inbox, we have a listener who has fallen hard for a guy, but he is in the prison release program. You may think, like, seriously? Yeah, seriously. But he's a baby Christian, which is a good thing. But our listener worries that he may one day end up back in prison. What should she do? One of our counselors is going to weigh in on that. And then for our culture segment, we have author Laura Lynn Hughes here. And she has words of encouragement for those who may be faced with a hard choice of keeping a baby or having an abortion. She herself was in that situation, as well as her daughter. So she has a lot of life experience here. And we're going to discuss her book, Choose Zoe, in which she details a lot of her own experiences and how she is now ministering to folks with unplanned pregnancies. Well, here we are for our roundtable, and we are going to talk about a dating-related topic, namely getting set up. What are the ins and outs of it? Is it an okay thing? Is it not okay? Does it actually work for people? So fortunately, we have got Chris, Jenny, and Josh here to discuss. Hey, guys.
How you doing?
Hey.
Great to have you. All right. Now, the art of the setup, I have been there, and I was actually pondering this and thinking to myself, I can't really think of a setup I've had that really was bad. Like, I have been on really bad dates, y'all. I've been on some, and listeners, y'all know, you've heard of some of them. But most often, my setups were not the bad ones, which, I don't know, that's problematic. That means that the ones I chose were worse than what other people choose for me, which I don't know. There could be some wisdom in that. But we want to talk about getting set up, because I actually am a proponent of it. I always say, you know, for all these singles that are like, I can't find anyone to date, well, who better to, like, help you find someone than people that know and love you best? And so I think it's totally legit and worth being open to. But let's just talk first about general thoughts about getting set up. I mean, that's my opinion. What do you guys think? Yay or nay?
I don't think it's a bad thing.
Okay.
I guess it just depends on the person and, you know, the family, just like you talk about family or friends who's setting it up, and the, you know, and the other person as well. So. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, spoiler alert, it worked for me, so I am a fan of it.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I think, as you were saying, Lisa, that people not only know you well, but theoretically would know the other person they're setting you up with well. And I think that's, in a sense, a picture of the body of Christ, mm-hmm. knowing mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. works well together. I had a pastor growing up who used to say, if two people get together and they're very similar, one of them's useless. And so I like the idea of somebody being able to see ahead of me what works and what wouldn't work with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Like, what do you think as far as, like, the whole idea of the setup? I mean, do you think it's generally accepted or not? Like, I mean, to me, it just seems like it widens out your opportunities. I mean, because, again, you know people who know people who know people.
Right.
And I mean, it's not like you're, you know, weirdly just going after anyone.
No, I think people do it. Christians, non-Christians. You know, there's somebody else that knows somebody, and they think that you guys would be perfect.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
But the setup has to involve the right person setting you up. Like, if it's
grandma
who just found some sweet guy that delivers her mail, I'm
or
thinking,
let's be honest, your mother.
Okay.
Maybe that was my experience.
I didn't want to go there, but yes. That, I mean, you want the right person who you trust, who truly knows you and your motives, your heart, and can line that up well with someone.
Right. Yeah, I was set up probably, I don't know, 10, 15 times over the years probably by, you know, friends, but it wasn't until if it was a friend that really knew me well and really knew my now husband really well that thought, these people need to get together.
Okay.
For me, I guess unlike your situation, Lisa, I felt like a lot of times people would just set me up because they knew somebody else that was single, and they knew I was single, and I was certainly open to it. So it was like, great, here is these two single people, let's put them together. And it was a train wreck most of the time. So
Yeah, which is, I mean, because there's part of me that's kind of like, okay, well, if you're just going to do coffee or just lunch, then, you know, whatever. You don't have to have this person's blood type and be all like, are we spiritually compatible on all elements of doctrine and whatever. But at the same time, it does help when people do a little recon, right. I would think, on the front end.
Or know your type a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah. Well, okay, so to that point, Jenny, what was it? I mean, why were some setups unsuccessful versus successful? What would you say were the key differentiating factors?
Well, type, I guess, would be one. I'm just thinking of the train wrecks over the years. Yeah, just very, I mean, I think very quickly, if you're looking for it, you can find kind of where their faith is. Mm-hmm. Just from, you know, a conversation over coffee or over lunch, like you said, it's not to be a big deal, but I think you can see a lot just from, you know, a conversation. You know, there's obviously, you know, different, you know, whether I felt immediately attracted to someone, which isn't, you know, make it or break it necessarily, right. but mm-hmm. that was sometimes missing. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes they were very attractive and I just wasn't attracted to their personality or mm-hmm. I don't know. And it's hard. You can't always tell from a first impression, but
yeah,
that was my experience anyway.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. Josh, I know you tend to be a setter-upper mm-hmm. now on this end of things because you did, I mean, you met your wife at church
mm-hmm.
and,
right.
you know, you have your whole story around that, but you kind of like being the person to be a little bit of a meddler. What does that look like for you?
Yes, and I'm a happy meddler. I've definitely seen, just having been a youth pastor and a church planner in my background, I have this heart to want to protect and shepherd and help guide people. So there's a lot of times, especially with guys, the setting up involves a lot of, hey, step up. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's interest here. Go and do something with it. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of like the pre-setup is like, she's a great girl. She would fit you. And it's encouraging them that direction. Mm-hmm. I found myself with the young ladies in the church that I've shepherded, it's maybe a little more protective. And it's been, you see what he's doing. He's not giving you clarity or he's giving you all these signals, but he's not telling you what they mean. Go and kind of demand that. Mm-hmm. And so both genders have gotten direction from me, but in a little different direction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to say, too, I've now been a setter-upper myself, having it worked for me. And I think it was just kind of being inspired by how it can work mm-hmm. and, you know, just knowing the desire of a friend of mine here at Focus and knowing of somebody else who, you know, was a really great guy who would make a really great husband and just thinking, well, you know, what can happen? You know, you never mm-hmm. know. And, it turned into a beautiful relationship and they're married with kids now. So,
it's
I think it's a good thing to encourage people towards that. Cause I think especially for the husband, like it wasn't on his mind, you know, he was in his 20s and not necessarily looking toward marriage or anything. And, you know, we kind of took him aside and was like, there's this great girl and you should look into this. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be something. So,
yeah, it's interesting how just having that like little prompting mm-hmm. can mm-hmm. be helpful. And I think, I mean, just even from single guys that I've known, that tends to kind of give them the nudge they need because either it's not on their radar or they're mm-hmm. like vastly underestimating themselves or they think that they need to have more like ducks in a row than mm-hmm. they do. Or some girl's like way out of their league. Mm-hmm. And then this girl's like, why are you not asking me out? And she's all offended. And right. so it just seems to clear up a lot of misconceptions, especially when, I've had it where an older guy especially has come alongside, you know, a guy and just said, look, you know, there's no reason for you not to be asking her out right. and just kind of giving him a little bit of a challenge.
Take the awkwardness out of it. Like, it's not a big deal. Just do it. Like,
okay.
You say that.
I'm the female. So,
Chris, let's talk about you. Okay, because you're our resident single guy here.
Yes,
okay, and I'm the resident single lady. So let's just talk about what are some of the, and Josh and Jenny talk from experience, what are some of the ground rules here? Because, you know, to Jenny's point, you don't want just total randomness of like, clearly you want the other person to be a believer. You want to like know some good things about their faith. You want to cut out stuff that's just dumb that you know is not going to go anywhere and not going to work, and not just have the, mm-hmm. per Jenny's point, like, hey, you're both single. You must be a match. What would be other good areas of, areas to keep in mind that would be kind of compatibility things or things to just, you know, make a good fit, would you say?
Well, this is kind of cool because I've never been in the situations that you two have talked about.
Mm-hmm. But you're open, you said.
Yeah, okay. I'm definitely open to that.
Send us your contact info.
Exactly.
I would say, obviously, first, whoever is approaching me about that, And there are some questions. Are they in Christ?
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about them? You know, do you have a relationship with them? If you know about their past relationships, how did that go?
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of ask general questions like that to see if you're interested, even ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. I mean, just establish if there's even, do you even have knowledge of that person?
Right.
Like if you're at the same church or whatever, just get some interesting info there. Yeah.
Absolutely. I was talking to one of my coworkers months ago, and I thought, wow, he would be a great fit for this young woman who was at our church back in Missouri. And mm-hmm. I thought, man, I could see them connecting really easily.
A long distance setup?
Well, what? But she wanted to relocate here.
Oh, oh
so
okay.
There was a lot of reasons in my mind yeah. why it would be a good fit. And I approached her and I said, hey, kind of where are you at? And she's like, oh, I'm very open to being set up. And I approached him and he said, no, at this time in my life, I'm really not, because he had some other commitments. Mm-hmm. And I think knowing where he was at, mm-hmm. obviously, rather than just trying to go around the situation and just make it happen in some kind of sneaky way, I think the motive of the person doing the setting up mm-hmm. is very important. And I just have their both interest in mind, and he mm-hmm. wasn't interested. So mm-hmm. You don't ignore that.
Mm-hmm. I had someone approach me while at Alive from New York, and from one of the coworkers. It's like, yeah, you'd be pretty good with
which
this.
Is a thing we had going on here at Focus. So
yeah.
our New York event we talked about. Yeah, go ahead.
Awesome. So, yeah, they was like, oh, you what about Chris? I was like, oh, you asking about me? Oh, okay. And the person was like, well, they're not at a good place right now because they had just got out of a relationship. So they wanted to mm-hmm. be single. I was like, okay, that's definitely cool. I was very respectful.
Check back in a week.
Yeah, check back in a week.
No, longer if you're a girl.
Yeah. They're over it. They've eaten their ice cream. They're mm-hmm. over it. Okay, what about, like, has there been anything where someone's, like, tried to set you up with someone and you're like, what, seriously? Like, okay, because I've had this, like, here's my personal offense, especially now, you know, that it, like, since I've been in my mid to late 30s and mm-hmm. now 40, is like, they want to set me up with someone mm-hmm. and I'm just like, that dude is like old, y'all. Like,
what are you saying?
Like, I'm like, do not pick people that are like 20 years older than I am. I am sorry, but I just like feel younger than that.
You and
I, yeah, I know. But like, why is that? That's offensive.
I had a situation where my now mother-in-law tried to set me up with someone, and we were working together, my mother-in-law and I, before she was my mother-in-law, and I really respected her. I valued her opinion, and she directed me toward this one young woman, and her name was Amy, and she was just trying to say, hey, she's got great character. She's very theologically minded. She's got a great heart, servant's heart, and I think you guys would be a great fit. So I started to pursue Amy, and we spent a lot of time together one-on-one. We would watch movies, and we would go out for some meals or coffee, and she invited me up to this conference at her college where Jerry Bridges was speaking, right? So I'm thinking, wow, you know, this is great, and I'm going to ask her at this event if we can go to that next level. And so I sat her down. I said, Amy, I really enjoy our time together and would love to, you know, pursue, like, exclusivity. And she goes, what? And I said, well, I'd like you to be my girlfriend. She's like, what are you talking about? We're just friends. We've been hanging out for like 2 months, one-on-one. And so I think it's really important as the person setting someone up to inform both parties that, you know, you might.
She didn't know it was a setup.
She didn't really know that all of the time we'd been spending together was, you know, had a romantic, like, intention, or at least investigatively. So it was just a very funny story that I now throw in my mother-in-law's face. But, yeah, I think that's an important detail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, which is, like, you totally have that. You know, I always say that's a good thing about online dating, because everyone who's online, you're there for the purpose of finding someone.
Right, you would think.
Okay, well, let's...
Yeah.
Other than the players and weirdos.
Yeah.
Well, they say, like, they say that they're interested in dating, but then they just get into these weird pen pal things.
Right.
So they don't know how to pull the trigger or whatever. But generally, you know that you're not just, hi, I'm on this online dating site so I can find a friend. Like, very few people will say that. So that's good. But I think your point is a good one, Josh, in the sense of, like, setup should be that too. Like, they're actually looking for someone to marry eventually, or to, you know, get in a long-term
intentional
relationship.
For sure.
Yeah. You don't want it to just be like, hey, here's some people that randomly are in your age group. Though I will say that one of the most awesome setups I had was a group setup, and that was really fun. So it was this family friend who went to a church in the city I lived in, and she knew that there were four of us girls that rented a house together, and we, the four of us, went to different churches. But she had a couple younger guys in her church that she worked with, and she's like, there are these four great girls, grab two of your friends and invite them out to go do something. And we did. We all went cross-country skiing, and it ended up being a really fun evening, because then it wasn't like, you have to pair off and you have to pair off. It was just kind of this group date, and they all paid for us, and it ended up being really fun. So I think that's a great idea too.
Yeah. Nice.
The other thing that I'm really open to is, and I think you can do this whether you're, you know, certainly like married couples and families can kind of own this space, but, you know, singles, we can do it for our friends too, is to host something and invite people over that you think might be good, you know, connections and
on
stuff.
On the down low, of course.
Yeah, I mean, or on the pseudo dumb, you know, kind of like being a little bit more a friend about it. But at the same time, kind of one of those, like whether it's a game night or a party or something like that, you just know you're going to put people together that might hit it off. And, you know, it doesn't have to be, here are the two single people, so I'm just going to invite them and it's going to be really obvious. Mm-hmm. But just, you know, it can be a mixed group or odd numbers or whatever, but it just gives that space for people to get to know one another.
That's my standard operating procedures. My wife and I will host a lot of things with our college and career age folks at church. And we intentionally invite people to, and not just two single people, like you're saying, but we'll do that just because we love hosting. We love having young people in our home. And then it's just fun to watch what transpires in the evening, like who hits it off, and it's just a good way to hang out.
Yeah. I will say one thing that's kind of exhausting about the setup is you tend to, it's often with someone that you do not know at all. So then you kind of have to clear out all that space of like, so how long have you lived here? And all the like chit chats.
Yeah.
So, but it can be an easy way to get some questions answered, I guess, and break the ice in that sense. Yeah. So that, you know, tends to be okay in a sense, but if you do like too many of them, it's like, and here's another interview for potential date people. I don't know. So how, Jenny, how did you know moving forward with your now husband, like I mean, did you know at the end of that first date that you're like, we want to do this again?
Well, yes, I guess. It took him,
or one of you did.
It took him 4 months to get around to calling me. When I got the call
after the first date.
No. So my friend had set us up.
Oh, okay.
At least told me she was going to set us up, and I heard nothing for 4 months.
Nice.
And, okay. Yeah, I was like, oh man, another one bites the dust. There.
That's because Josh didn't know him. He didn't have a chance.
I would have been on there.
No. Apparently, he had just started dating someone else. All right.
Had to clear that one out.
Yeah. So I forgot all about him and had several other kind of fellas on the horizon, and then out of the blue just got a Facebook message actually from him, and one thing led to another, and we were sitting at Starbucks, and we had, you know, on Facebook we had done quite a bit of messaging, so we'd gotten through all the dumb questions, you know, and I just kept sitting there thinking, gosh, I hope this is my last first date. I sure hope it is. And he pursued and was consistent in that, and
great.
All from there, I guess.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, and it helped that you were in the same town. And
it did help that we were in the same town. We'd both been baristas and cared quite a bit for a certain beverage and had a lot of other things in common, too.
Did you ever have, like, some type of match who can make this barista drink or, you know, Americano or whatever?
Well, no. And neither of us were, you know, it had been in our past, so... No, but we do enjoy a good coffee date. So.
That's awesome.
So what would you say, what are some, just kind of as we round out our discussion here, what are just some good general tips for people in being open to setups, in orchestrating a setup, in navigating your first date after being set up? What are some do's and don'ts, would you say?
You got to ask the people who you're trying to set up if they even want it.
Okay.
You got to know where they're at, because there's no reason just to meddle and hurt people's feelings and get somebody's hopes up. And
it's going to be sensitive, thing. So there's definitely an art to approaching it with intentionality and like, I care about you, and I just was thinking of you and think, you know, maybe this would be a good thing, and I don't, you know, obviously I'm not God, I don't know, but you know, would you be open to this? Pray about it. Usually kind of the response. So
That's good.
As far as if you want to be set up, definitely your network of people, you know, friends and close family and, you know, anybody you would trust. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's got a great marriage that mm-hmm. you see that you really respect.
Yeah. Right.
Have them, you know, just keep their eyes open. That's, you know, the friend that did set me up. We years ago, actually, we were talking about it on this podcast. We sent out postcards to our friends and family mm-hmm. and just asking them, you know, keep your eyes out, please, because we're, you know, we're searching for fellas to date and, you know, yeah. marriage is something we want to pursue. So, yeah, it took a couple of years, but
that's cool.
There's finally fruit from that. So, yeah. Yeah.
I think, too, one other thing that comes to mind for me is just to be sensitive about, like, any, you know, like mitigating circumstances or any, like, for example, if the person that you want to set up or be set up with or whatever is divorced or has mm-hmm. kids, like mm-hmm. kind of, you know, go through those minefields and just figure out, like, what is their situation? Where are they? Like, and you know, are they, is there a sense of healing there? Mm-hmm. Is there, you know, have they been released, you know, to remarry, mm-hmm. to remarry, you know, by their church or whatever, you know, whatever the parameters are there. What does that look like? 'Cause I know, you know, some people have really strong opinions about that, about what that looks like and stuff. So.
Yeah. Or mm-hmm. even like what would their, you know, what would you call it? Like something that would really make them say no.
Mm-hmm.
I had one minor relationship where the young lady did not think, she didn't like spanking. And that was that was her yeah. heart.
Yeah. Right? Non-negotiable.
Yeah, yeah, that was the non-negotiable. And, she
and
was
you're
like,
just all for it. And Chris is like, if there's one thing
that's
awesome,
I've got a girl for you.
Yeah. If there's right circumstances and situations. Yeah.
If there's one thing I'm passionate about, here it is. Let's put it out there. No, that's good though. Well, and I mean, in some ways, it kind of matters like where the person is in life. You know, mm-hmm. if a person, you know, especially like for females, this can be pretty sensitive. You know, you don't want to like take on some guy that's like not graduated yet from college and now has $100K mm-hmm. in student loan debt or just, you know, not that that has to be a deal breaker, mm-hmm. but just be sensitive to, you know, life situations, where people are. And again, even just, yeah. you know, certain beliefs or certain preferences in that sense. I think that's all good too. So
for sure.
Cool. Well, thanks you guys for weighing in on this. Good thoughts all together.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks for having this. Yeah. Was cool.
Thanks, Lisa.
And I learned some things from you too.
Very good.
Get out there and get on it.
Absolutely. Good thoughts. Hold on. Well, hey, everyone. You know, if you read our e-newsletter and other stuff we have going on here at Boundless, that not too long ago, I had the privilege of being part of our Alive from New York event in Times Square. And we had a Boundless meetup there and I got to co-host our simulcast. And it was just really, I mean, chills to be there as a 4D ultrasound was broadcast there really for the world to see and to see the hush come over the crowd. And, you know, we're having this conversation heading towards 50 years after Roe v. Wade was legalized. And I think it really makes a difference when we can put a face on life and realize that these are not just public policy issues, but they're real women's lives and babies' lives. And so today, today's guest I want to introduce you to, Laura Hughes. She is the author of Choose Zoe. And actually, it's a story of unplanned parenthood and the case for life. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lisa.
Well, you have quite a story that you detail in this book, and obviously are very involved in pro-life activities now. But I want you to talk a little bit to our audience, first off, about your background, because you grew up Catholic and considered yourself very pro-life, and yet found yourself with an unplanned pregnancy at age 15. Tell us about just that moment and what went through your mind.
Well, absolutely. For one, I was not prepared for sex. That's for sure. It's meant to really bond us together, and in that context, in marriage, bring forth children. And so finding out that I had an unexpected pregnancy, which really led to unplanned parenthood, I was fearful, but I was also very contemplative. And as I felt the baby growing inside of me, my love for her grew so much that even though I had a terrible relationship with my boyfriend, and society was against unplanned pregnancies, and I, you know, was concerned about what my parents would think and people in the church, I still really just kind of resonated off that love that I had for my child. And I think that that's why the outcome for her was so positive, is it was because I was able to remember the things that my family had taught me, remember the things my church had taught me, and accept life, even though I had been disobedient.
Yeah. I think one of the coolest things that you detail in the book is just the reaction of your parents and, you know, probably not expecting this, figuring that this wouldn't be part of your story or their story. Talk through what that looked like when you finally were able to tell them and how they responded.
Yeah, it was totally amazing. I let everybody guess that I was pregnant. And when my mother found out, she told me she was going to tell Dad on the way home from the airport. So I called my boyfriend, and we went and hid in the church parking lot. at least we kind of knew where to go, right? And I came home in the middle of the night about 3:30, thinking I could sneak in before my dad would be up reading the Bible. And when I walked in the door, I just looked at him, took one look at him. He stood up, and I just burst into tears. And he came over to me and embraced me and told me how much that he loved me and that Mom told him that I was pregnant, that I was going to have a child, and that all he asked was that I would pray every day what was best for my baby, whether it was me raising her with, you know, some of their guidance, or whether it was me placing her in loving arms of people waiting to adopt. And then he said, get to bed. You have school in a couple of hours. Hmm. And so that day I really felt grace from a parent, and I feel like it's that same thing that the prodigal son must have had after he messed up so bad. And, you know, he came home, and if you remember that story, you remember that the dad plays God, right? And he runs to that son and puts his arms around him, and he did the same thing that my dad did to me. And so that's the real heart of a father, the real picture of what a dad does when we come home and come home to our senses.
Yeah, sure. Well, and again, just thinking that you were 15 years old. So you had, I mean, this obviously rocked your world and changed the way that you lived into your 20s and beyond, really the rest of your life. And we probably have a fair number in our audience, Laura, who, you know, have either had babies at young ages, whether a teenager or early 20s and unmarried, or maybe they've had abortions. What would you say was kind of most pivotal in your story leading into young adulthood that really made you come, you know, have to grapple with what your life was going to look like moving forward? And what would be some strategies that you would share for others who are in the same spot?
Well, I think that having the child at 15, I gave birth to her at 16, and that was joyous. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing like the smell of a new baby and holding her. But, you know, she was raised without a dad, and she was raised in poverty. And within 1 year, like many statistics, I also was pregnant again. And that little boy was born at 22 weeks, and he was not so lucky. Mm. And so experiencing great joy and then great heartache in one child that, you know, that I gave birth to and one child that I miscarried, it was so much emotion that we're not prepared for. So I was, you know, welcomed into postpartum loss, which is very, very tough. So all of those things combined were way too much for me at a young age, coupled with, you know, not a good relationship with my boyfriend. And so they really kind of set me up for heartache. And then they also set me up for more sexual immorality. And I had 3 unplanned pregnancies by 21 years old. I had a broken heart. And when we walk away from God's absolute truth, that's what happens is, you know, we end up with a broken heart. We end up with, you know, abortions or STIs or children that are, you know, raised without another parent. And so many things that we do, and that's the message I'd really love to get to the listeners, is the decisions that we make day by day, listening to the culture, listening to, you know, what sexual freedom is, all of those things are meant to just cause destruction in our lives. You know, and society feeds to us that we can be free, we can have sexual freedom, but it actually creates bondage in our lives. We become enslaved by, you know, the immorality. And so any decisions that we make can be undone and redeemed by the power of God. So I pray that your listeners will wake up and will understand that even if they've made mistakes, even if they have had children outside of wedlock, babies are always a blessing. The sexual immorality is sin. It keeps us from God. It keeps us, our eyes off of God and onto a relationship. And so any of the things that are causing division in your life are definitely not from the Lord. And he has better for us. He sent his son Jesus to give us the, you know, the wonderful life now, the best life here on earth. And so whatever we have done or whatever has been done to us, God wants us to stop in our tracks right now and choose his ways, choose his moral truths, because that's when we're going to be fulfilled. That's when we're going to really feel free. And that's what we're all seeking for, is to be set free and to be loved and to experience life and good relationships. And it's just never too late for us. I was way older than your audience by the time I got it together and accepted the love of the Lord. I always went to church. I felt like I knew God, but something was still always missing. So sometimes when you open yourself up to sexuality and pregnancy and things when you're way too young, it kind of stops your growth process. Mm. But that is something that the Bible talks about, where it's stolen from us, the years that are stolen from us, that God can give those back to us. Mm-hmm. And we can always make a new choice for righteousness and godliness and making good decisions. That's the beauty of it.
Mm-hmm. So I think, Laura, what a lot of the culture will say, and people in the culture, and we're seeing this even now publicly in the media and beyond, is, well, okay, Laura, what you should have done is you should have just taken matters into your own hands, and you weren't prepared to care for that baby, and you weren't prepared to have these 3 pregnancies. And so, you know, abortion is the answer, or doing what you need to do on your timetable to solve the problem and make this happen. What would be your argument to folks who say that? And then what really was that pivotal point in your own story that turned your understanding of God around?
Well, I definitely know that the pivotal time in my story was just over and over knocking my head against the same sin. And when you keep having habitual sin, it gets worse each time. And so, you know, I wasn't a quick learner when it came to disobedience. And when we understand that being obedient to God's laws is actually a good thing, we're created for love. We're created to thrive. And, you know, we're created for that real openness that can only come from a relationship with the Lord. We can seek all kinds of things, like that prodigal son. He had the inheritance. He blew it. He had money. He had prostitutes. You know, he just blew it all. And one day we wake up and we're just not happy. We can feel empty. We can feel lonely. And the only thing that is going to fill that is the truth of God. The only thing that's going to fill that is the love of the Lord.
Hmm. Well, I know that you're, you know, you had your daughter, Erica, and she now has kids of her own. And even in her story, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I think everyone would say, oh, okay, well, Laura can say that because her story's just wrapped up with a bow. And I'm sure everything became easy after that. And, you know, they'll look at your story. I mean, you are now, you volunteer at your local pregnancy clinic and mobile unit. You're the founder of A Movement of Love. Yet even, you know, sometimes it's hard to break cycles, like you said, of sin. And tell us about how that played out in your own daughter's story as she found herself pregnant.
Well, you know, it's generational. So there's things that need to be broken generationally. And so just because I chose life, it doesn't set you up to know for sure what your own children will do, because the lies are so prominent in our culture. And when my daughter was faced with an unplanned pregnancy, she didn't tell anyone. This is very common. You listen to the world. You listen to just take care of it. You can finish college. And the world wants to feed you so many lies, like you're going to be poor. You're not going to be able to go to college. You're not married. What are people going to think? But if you can just silence that noise long enough, you can realize that you can climb that hill. You can overcome those obstacles. And my daughter has, after her healing, after her abortion, been able to climb those obstacles, and it's that road to redemption. So God always gives us a road to redemption, and my life has not been a tiny little bow. Because of my decisions in my early teens and 20s, not only myself, but my children still suffer consequences for that. And I know that most people that see me now and they think, oh, well, look where she's come. She must have an easy life now. No, there's still ramifications of kids with different dads. There's still divorce in my life. There are things that I have to help my children get through and climb over in order to succeed in life, in order to accept Christ. My kids are tremendous. They all are really tremendous, and they're doing such a good job in society, and they're caring for others, and they're educated. And all of those things are statistics that, you know, the world said they shouldn't have made those accomplishments being raised by a teen mom. So, yeah, things might look glorious, but there was some really tough things to get through. That's why I like being at the center, mm-hmm. because then I'm in the center of people's stuff, and I remember what it felt like, and I remember what helped me, and I remember what brought me hope.
Yeah.
And we can all do that for other people. The scripture tells us to encourage one another, and we can all do that no matter what our story is.
Yeah. So I know you've mentioned, I think you mentioned in the book, even stories of some of the women who come into the center as you're working there, including, I mean, it's just mind boggling, but even 12-year-old girls walking in there. What's your message of hope to them, Laura? Because I know, you know, I think we understand, or maybe we don't understand enough as the church, that ground on this issue and in people's lives isn't going to be gained in an angry space. But really, what do these young girls and women need to hear? What do they need to understand?
Well, they need hope. They need someone to celebrate them, their life, and the life of their child. And when they can take the focus off of all of their problems and their anxiety and the bad relationship, and when they can focus on the love that they have for their child, just like my dad asked me to pray every day what was best for my baby, when you get the focus onto the baby, then something beautiful can happen. I mean, imagine how the Virgin Mary was, right? When she finds out that she's got this unexpected to her, but not unplanned by God by any means. But imagine how she felt way back then as a teenager. And what she said was, be it unto me. And it said she would ponder these things in her heart. And so when she got her focus on Jesus, literally on the baby in the womb, then she was able to silence all of the culture, all of the things that were going to attack her and come against her. And Joseph was able to come into play too, because there's always a young man. And many times the young men come into the center. And I love that, because the majority of men say, whatever you want to do. They bought into a lie that it's the woman's choice, woman's body, and they say, whatever you want to do. And when that happens, the girls always tell me they felt hopeless. They felt like the guy didn't want the baby, even if he didn't say it. So there's power in a young man's words. And it's time for the men, too, to come along and take responsibility, but also share love for the child. And it's a total lie that men shouldn't have a conversation or a voice concerning the unborn or abortion. It's their children, for goodness sakes. It's their family. It's their future. They definitely have a voice. And so when they abdicate their responsibility and they tell the woman, it's okay, whatever you decide, you know, I'll support you, that usually means, you know, it's fine to take the life of the unborn.
Yeah. So what would you say, what is your advice to men who may be listening, who may have, you know, be in that exact situation? What course of action should they take and what should they say to, you know, I think a lot of times they're told by women, well, this has nothing to do with you, or this isn't your business, or it's not your decision. What, you know, what would be your advice to them?
Just for them to offer support. You know, anything you would do for a friend if they were having any other type of problem, just offer that love and that support and let them know that you'll be standing by their side, that you can do this. And, you know, for men to know that there really are absolute truths in the Bible. There's morality. There's absolute truths. And when they stick by those absolute truths, then they will always have a positive outcome when it comes to their decisions when a girl may be pregnant. And this doesn't even have to be their own child. Mm-hmm. This can be their sister becomes pregnant. Men are so powerful in their voice and authority, and they are made to love, and they are made to lead the family and provide and protect for the children. And so when they stand up and they say, I'll support you, I'll find you the kind of help that you need, whether it's their child in the womb or not. That's what Joseph did. Hmm. But be reminded, an angel had to come and talk to Joseph and say, hey, you're going to take care of that child, you're going to be the father, and you're going to marry Mary. That's the first thing that the angel had to do. So as a society, we need to do that. As a society, we need to say, you know, let's support you in taking care of the children. Let's promote family. Let's not just put everything on the young girl where she has to feel hopeless and alone. So men are powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What men say, we take to heart. Yeah. And men are still the number one coercers of abortion. The second is the mother. But the man is always the most powerful voice for the decision that the young lady is going to make.
Yeah. Well, I think because we have been hearing the topic of life and abortion so much in the news and legislatively, I hear from a lot of women who will say, oh, well, you know, no, I'm pro-life. I don't want abortion, but, you know, Lisa, here's a great example. Like, what if, you know, what if my child in the womb, they discover that he or she has Downs? Or what if I'm a rape victim? And they start putting parameters on it, which kind of takes away the definition of life itself. What would you say, what do you say to the women who kind of start putting out arguments against, you know, the personhood of the baby in those circumstances?
Well, I don't know, for starters, I don't know one woman who was even raped and had a child that may have made felt suicidal. I have never heard any of them say they regretted having that child.
Hmm.
So for one, they always say the child, you know, helped me want to live again because they were, you know, distraught over the rape. And then there's the people that say, oh, how on earth can I raise a child with Down syndrome? Well, there's so many resources out there where you can connect with other people who have raised those little darlings to where, you know, again, it's the education that we get. It's being informed. And the people that raise a Down syndrome child always say that that child brought more joy into the house, taught them to really love. And then there's also false diagnosis in the womb. I had false diagnosis in the womb. And so if I would have taken my child's life, then I would have never known that she was perfectly healthy. So for one, that's my youngest daughter, Mary. So little Mary, I was pregnant with, and I went in and it was an oblated ovum. The people that love medical can look into that. Basically a sperm and an egg meet. There's a pregnant sac, but there's no life in the womb. And I told the doctor, I said, I am not having an abortion. And he said, it's not an abortion. It's a DNC. I said, that's the same thing they do. And I said, I'm not taking life. And he says, lady, there's no life in your womb. And I walked out of that hospital room, and I threw the door open, and I looked up into the sky, and I held my finger up, and I said, God, you raised Lazarus from the dead. Now breathe life into my baby. A few weeks later, they found the baby. So back up even further to when she was 7 months in my womb, and her femurs were too short, her head was too big, she had a lot of fluid, so then they thought she was a dwarf and was going to have mental retardation. And it just went on and on. She was born premature. Her lungs weren't developed. That night, they said she wouldn't live through the night. And I just said, ha, you don't decide life. Well, my daughter Mary just gave birth on Sunday to twin baby girls, my 9th and 10th grandbabies. And so if I had taken Mary's life, which they said there was no life, they said it was not a good pregnancy, if I had listened to the doctors and taken her life, I would have not had her in my life, and I would not have her son, and I would not have twin grandbabies that were just born. I was just in the hospital last night holding two babies in my arm and just looking back and forth, head going back and forth, and my arms and heart were so full of love. And when we listen to doctors sometimes and we don't listen to God, we can cut off our family blessings. But then your heart goes out to someone whose story didn't end up like mine. There's so much pregnancy loss,
right,
with infertility and miscarriage and you know, stillborn, and there's so much healing available there. Not everyone has my story, but everyone has a part of God's story.
Well, that's why I think it's so important for us as believers, whether young adults in our audience or others, to encourage, to speak up on behalf for life, but also to encourage the moms and the dads who are making these tough decisions. And that's why I think the title of your book, Choose Zoe, is so important, meaning Zoe, meaning the abundant life, and how really it is. It's bigger than just a single baby or a single decision. It really is affirming God's what God says about life and about his creation. And so I think your story, Laura, is really shedding light on that. So thanks so much for being part of the conversation with your book, Choose Zoe.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I just bless your entire audience with making good decisions in your life that will cause you to live that abundant, eternal life that can start here right now, today, on earth, as it is in heaven, right?
Excellent.
You hold my every moment. You calm my raging seas. You walk with me through fire and heal. Thank you.
Well, we are finishing out the show by opening up our inbox, and we have Counselor Roberta here. Roberta, welcome.
Hi, Lisa.
It's been a little while since we've had you down here.
It has been. It's a pleasure to reconnect.
Well, great to have you back. So we have a question here. It is a relationship question, but kind of fraught with some of its own caveats here. So I'm going to just start reading. Our listener says, I met this guy at church about 5 months ago. He's in the prison pre-releases. He became a Christian while in prison about a year ago. The last 4 months, we've texted back and forth pretty much every day. He truly seems to really love God and is sorry for what he did that got him in prison. I originally told him after talking to him for about a month and a half, I couldn't date him, and he told me he wasn't interested in looking for a girlfriend. I have since fallen hard for him and think he may have also changed his mind. He's also moving real soon, though, to another state. I know the statistics aren't good for prisoners returning to jail, but I'm so torn about what to do. I've never felt this way about a guy before, so give me some insight, please.
Well, I think it's great that she reached out to get some insight and some guidance along this dating spectrum. Three things stood out to me that I'd like to highlight about this story that you just presented, Lisa. Number one, it sounds like that at the very beginning of those two interacting, that the caller already had set a clear boundary that she didn't want to date him. And so one of my recommendations would be for her to go back and revisit some of the reasons why at that time that she had decided that. She may find some wisdom in those that early decision that she may reconsider this current status that she's at. Mm-hmm. So I definitely would encourage her to go back and look at that, because she had clearly said, I don't want to date him. Number two, in the same sense, he clearly stated that I don't want to date anyone. Mm-hmm. So even though she's saying her heart has changed now, she's still not 100% certain where his heart is at, because he hasn't said anything different. She may experience him being more connected than other times, and it may feel like he wants something more. But once again, until he clearly says something different, I encourage her to consider that he is still saying, I do not want a girlfriend. And thirdly, and probably the most important to consider, is that this man is going to be getting out of prison soon. And to adjust to life after prison is going to take a lot of time and focus. And it's really important, especially with his new connection to the Lord, that he really takes that time and focus to get established in a career, to get a support system around him, and to really try to offset those statistics of relapse that she mentioned. And within that, he is actually saying, I'm going to move to a new state. So he may not even be in the same state. And what I'd like to challenge her to consider, the difference between the feeling of love and the action of love. She may have a sense of feeling for him. And I think that's sounds like the course of their interaction. She's experiencing that. But to show love may be to say, I need to take a step back so this person can get out, get established, take all the focus he needs to really take that next step in his life without focusing on a relationship.
Yeah.
So those are the three things.
Yeah, I think that's great advice, Roberta. And I think it's good, I mean, you know, for our listener and anyone to remember that, you know, a connection can be very real. We're not saying like, hey, you don't have a connection, or you don't know this guy, or whatever. I mean, you've been communicating, but that's so good to separate, you know, what you can experience online and in conversations versus reality. And there's so much more in his life that he's going to have to prioritize moving forward. It just seems like caution for her is really key.
Absolutely. And it sounds like she's been in a supportive role. I mean, that could have been mutual, but to continue that supportive role would say to herself, you know, number one, he's not saying clearly that he's interested in wanting a date. The last thing he did say is, I don't, probably because he wants to get out, focus on that foundation. And the best way she can support that is allowing that to take place.
Yeah, great point. Well, thank you so much. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week's show. As always, we do want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org, and we will answer your question on a future show. You can also go to boundless.org and search past shows for what we have answered in the past, because now, with over 10 years of shows under our belts, we have answered a lot of questions. So meanwhile, we are buzzing here through summer, and we're always grateful to have you with us. We will see you around next week. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.